the Ulster Economics Podcast. The podcast that keeps you up to date with what is happening economy-wise in Northern Ireland, telling you what you need to know, but not necessarily what you want to hear. It is better to be prepared for the economic environment we're operating in and not the world we'd like to be in. Episode 28, Fiscal Anxiety Cure, Hair of the Dog or Cold Turkey, with Lisa Wilson of the Nevin Economic Research Institute. Good morning, Lisa. It's great for you to join us here at Ulster Economics Podcast headquarters just after the bank holiday weekend, a sunny Tuesday morning. And Lisa, in terms of you're in the Nevin Economic Research Institute and you're also in the Fiscal Commission. If you could just tell us a little bit about those two organisations.
Yeah, so thanks very much, Richard, for having me onto the podcast. So the Nevin Economic Research Institute is a think tank, an all-island think tank with offices based in Belfast and in Dublin. We are funded by the umbrella of organisations which are affiliated to the Irish Congress of Trade Unions. And I suppose we do a range of research with a broad range focus on, you know, our economy. And I suppose I specialise a lot on our labour market related research. Separately, I was a member of the Independent Fiscal Commission, which has finished now. But the Independent Fiscal Commission was a commission which was instituted into place by the Minister of Finance, Conor Murphy, and chaired by Paul Johnston from the Institute for Fiscal Studies. And in broad terms, the remit of the Fiscal Commission was to look at the technocratic ability of Northern Ireland and the processes involved to devolve further, to get more devolved taxation powers to Northern Ireland, and what taxes might be suitable for that and which might not, and the processes involved in that. So thanks very much for having me.
Not at all. You're very welcome. And I suppose in terms of when we look at this fiscal anxiety, it could be said that the global economy is at present is characterised by financial anxiety. And I know anybody who's been at a barbecue over the weekend and who's then coming back into, has maybe had one or two Aperol spritzes or beers too many, and then coming in on a Tuesday morning and having work fear and all of that sort of stuff, knows what anxiety is all about. But with the financial version, it's consumers are experiencing that at the minute with the effects of rising food and utility bills and resulting nervousness about the state of their household finances going forward. This is particularly true for those mortgage holders due to see a surge in their mortgage payments in the coming months and years. And also sort of governments aren't immune to this effects of financial anxiety. We know in the US at the minute, there's been negotiations over raising the US federal debt ceiling. And it seems as if there's some sort of agreement there, but there were fears that what happens if that doesn't happen and then the government government in the US falls down and then they have to renegotiate to get it back up and running. And I suppose in terms of Northern Ireland, we're almost in the converse situation where a government shutdown is part of the cause of the fiscal anxiety that we're currently experiencing, and it's not just an outcome of it. We've no functioning executive, making dealing with the headache worse and leading to a potential perma hangover that we can't get out of. And no executive meant no in-year monitoring round, which leads to reallocation of in-year spending. And the absence of this created significant overspend. And unlike the US, Northern Ireland can't print more money. So there are many sham fights in Northern Ireland, but the budget constraints are very real. So I suppose in terms of Lisa, just to begin with, it's like in terms of the state of the public finances in Northern Ireland, how would you describe where we are in broad terms?
In broad terms, I suppose I've described we're not in a very good place. Our public finances obviously have been talked about endlessly over recent months in terms of the negative position and what they're in. But I don't think this is a new thing necessarily, the negative state of Northern Ireland finances. We are in one of those stages of flare where it's, you know, let's talk about it and let's discuss it because, we, you know, things have almost come to a head at the minute. And you're seeing a little bit of backwards and forwards in terms of negotiations between the UK government via Chris Heaton Harris and Northern Ireland to, I suppose, to prompt the executive back into place. But the state of Northern Ireland's finances have been an issue for quite some time now. That discussion amongst economists has never really gone away since, you know, certainly since I've become, you know, into the policy discussion in terms of economics in Northern Ireland, coming out of the 2008 crisis. We have been in this constant state of talking about the negative place of our finances ever since then.
And so it always seems to be, because I would agree with you as well in terms of since I've been in a working as an economist since 1997, a lot of the issues in terms of expenditure, issues with revenue, they have always long-term sustainability with Northern Ireland's public finances. We just haven't done that. That's always been put on the back burner. We kind of lurch from crisis to crisis, albeit I think the crisis that we're in now is something we haven't seen before, where it's financial sticking plasters are kind of put over things. But yes, it's we have always just focused on short term, and long term issues have been neglected. And in many ways, this is then coming back. And only this time, I think we maybe have to confront a lot of the challenges that hitherto now we have kind of kicked the can down the road.
I think the kind of discussion about the sustainability of, you know, public finances, and, you know, this being a unique to Northern Ireland thing, or we haven't got to, you know, to grasp with making our public finances sustainable, is a wee bit of exceptionalism. We have, you know, the same discussions happen in the Republic of Ireland where they talk about this finances, you know, needing to get them onto a more sustainable footing, particularly in regards to over reliance on corporation tax receipts and things. So we would
just love their surplus though.
100%. But you have these similar things. You know, this last year we had the Commission of Taxation and Welfare in the Republic report. And many of the things that they were talking about was, you know, talking about making their finances more sustainable, long-term investments in your economy. So this isn't a unique to Northern Ireland conversation. This does happen across economies right across Europe, where and you're always going to have this little bit of ebbs and flows between your revenues and your spending, and you should expect that, because it's almost part of, you know, it's the part of the politics of it all, is, you know, to have that kind of at the edges of it and have that kind of debate. But there is, of course, things that are unique to Northern Ireland then as it relates to the in and out of government and the stasis almost at this place is in as a result of that.
And it's almost like the unstable political institutions have then made, you know, they've basically compounded the unsustainability of the public finances, where you need to have, as a bedrock of stability, you need to have political institutions which can't fall down. And we can't get into this situation now where civil servants are being tasked to try and balance a budget, but they cannot make decisions because they haven't got ministers in place. So therefore, they cannot balance their budget, and kind of round and round that sort of goes.
Yeah, one of the key things whenever we were doing the Fiscal Commission stakeholder engagement, no matter who we spoke to, you know, businesses, trade unionists, policymakers, no matter who you talk to, they all raised that the political instability as the key issue which would prevent further devolution of taxation powers. They just didn't think that the political institutions were mature enough to be able to hold those powers and to be able to manage them appropriately. And that came up time and time again, no matter what the, you know, who the actor was that we were engaging with. I would hark back though, Richard, to what you said about, you know, in your intro about the overspend and that being related to the, you know, there being no Northern Ireland executive. Of course it was a factor, but
yeah,
you know, COVID and, you know, the inflationary environment and the Ukrainian crisis and all were, you know, fundamentally, you know, it does, you know, the external factors were almost, I would argue, greater than the impact of the internal.
But interestingly, all Northern Ireland was, the other Whitehall departments didn't actually have an overspend because they had the mechanisms to deal with that
in place.
In place. So the 670 odd overspend, yes, it was linked to inflation, energy costs, all of those kind of things. But unlike in Whitehall, they kind of dealt with that kind of in year. Northern Ireland didn't. They didn't have an executive. They couldn't do that. They couldn't nip it in the bud, you know, or deal with that. But then I suppose in Northern Ireland, they would argue there's other sort of like factors kind of on top of that, which are, you know, are making things. They would talk about other pressures that they had. But yes, so no, that's clearly was an issue.
Yeah. Because even whenever you look into where that, you know, the overspend came from, you know, I feel sorry almost for the ministers and the civil servants who were responsible and the departments responsible for it. So when you look at what it was, you know, continuation of legal aid, it was, you know, cancer services, it was basic things which you would expect in an advanced economy. And I guess, yeah, perhaps what you're missing was them advocates or the politicians from Northern Ireland to call and put pressure on the UK government for the continuation of basic public services, which an advanced economy such as the UK, which we're within, should expect. And perhaps to have that little bit of in-year-round monitoring, which would, you know, have, you know, changed the allocation of finances from, you know, from other departments, you know, to those which were facing, you know, the most pressures. But
And so far, the Secretary of State, Chris Heaton-Harris, has kind of, he improved things at the margins in terms of creating the budget last at the end of April, and the departments had now certainty of how bad things were. In some ways, it wasn't as bad as some of them thought, but at least they had that certainty. There was also, in terms of the $300 million sort of borrowing that to shore up their finances, which was due to be paid back in this financial year, spread over two years. It improves things at the margins, but we're not in a position of still getting out of the kind of difficulties, because we've had two months of the financial year already gone, and the Northern Ireland departments, they're not focused on kind of long-term investment and plans and strategies. It's kind of like firefighting and what do they do in the short term, which is again what we want to do, is how do we get back to a sustainable financial path. And so what would sustainable finances look like in Northern Ireland? I know what the Secretary of State was then highlighting. If you have got some of these difficulties, there's 700 million-ish of Northern Ireland kind of unique benefits in terms of everything from lower tuition fees, water charges, free prescriptions, all of those kind of things, which aren't necessarily, you wouldn't necessarily get the revenue from all of those, but that seems to be where the Secretary of State and previous Secretary of States, going back to Peter Hain, we're then always trying to, how can we encourage people to get back into government? We'll say we're going to do some of these kind of nasty things that the electorate won't like. But what are your thoughts on both in terms of what will sustainability look like, and then in terms of the revenue side? You know, we've talked a lot about the pressure on spending, but what about the revenue side?
So I think, you've called it out correct in recent weeks in terms of saying, like, the expectation that you might get politicians back into power by, you know, threatening them with going to their electorate and saying, you know, some of the things that you've been getting, either you're going to have to pay for them now, or we're going to take away that. So it's not a good place to start, you know, for Chris Heaton-Harris to start to try and, you know, in a political sense, you know, to encourage politicians to get back around the table. But in terms of the super priority issues is that they're often talked about, these areas of policy which Northern Ireland benefits from in ways which, you know, other the rest of the population of the UK and GB do not. And the cost, you know, the money which we decide to spend on that, and the cost of that. And this is where Chris Heaton Harris has been taking the argument, you know, is that we should either, you know, seek to raise further revenue via some of those measures and to seek to close that fiscal gap so that those unique, you know, unique policies are not there.
Do you think that will happen? Do you think the kind of the days of tuition fee, lower tuition fees or the not having water charges are numbered?
I think the policy impetus and the policy pressure is definitely there to stop doing that. And, you know, some, you know, you have to look at some of the possible areas of raising revenue via that. And one of the big ones is via tuition fees. And one of the things you have to think about is we have a huge issue with a lot of our students leaving and going to GB and never coming back, you know, so we lose the human capital, which we've brought through the education system, you know, until they're 18 and then they leave. They work in GB or elsewhere in the world and they never come back to Northern Ireland. Having lower tuition fees is a way in which we might try and encourage some students to stay here because they don't get into the same level of student debt as what they do if they went to study in England. So there's a risk to doing that at the same time. Although
they will only have to start paying the tuition fees back and the student debt back if they get a job of a certain salary and all of that sort of thing. So a lot of people who do then take on the student debt, that student debt is sort of never paid off because of the jobs that they sort of get. And my concern is that while you think you would want tuition fees as low as possible, that's putting a burden on the universities to actually increase, you know, where they're sort of capped the number of places they have because they have to subsidize that. But so, and there's been talk about whether that is going to sort of, I think Department for the Economy is in, they've been suggesting scenarios of whether it would be not increased to the UK level, but, you know, somewhere in between.
And I suppose what I'm saying is not in support or against the tuition fees. I'm just saying at all of these points, we're making choices. And we're assuming the choices that we're making is a bad one and should we do the other thing, it will be a good one and we'll get the good economic benefit from it. And it's a little bit more grey than that. The same when it comes to water charges. So we had, whenever I sat as a member of the Fiscal Commission, we had put a request to the Department of Finance to ask how much we were forgoing via the block grant by having no water charges. And the figure was, I think it was 297 million. Then the Fiscal Council have a figure of 450, I think it is, million of what revenue we would raise should Northern Ireland instill water charges. It is a notional figure, though, based on the assumption that all of the population, you know, so they get the number of households and they multiply it by 800 and that's the figure that they arrive at. It's still unclear to me where the gap between the money, you know, that we take off the block grant and the number which the Fiscal Council have got, where that gap, you know, because there's a gap of about 150 million, which is not to be sneezed at. But even still, despite the fact, even without, if the two figures were the same, it is notional to say that everybody across the board of all households will pay this amount of money. The civil servant who'd be tasked to sit down and figure out how much water charges households in Northern Ireland could afford would be faced with the reality that some households, you know, are looking at discretionary incomes of, you know, a discretionary spend after they pay their necessities in a week of about £20. So the notion that all the households are going to be paying £800 per year, it's a wee bit far stretched from reality. And then you get into the place where, you know, okay, then we'll have a tapered system through the water charges system. And, you know, some people, based on their ability to pay, won't be able to afford. And then that gets into the discussions of fairness based on what happens in England. You know, is it fair that, you know, some households in Northern Ireland don't have to pay it? So again, you get into all of these kind of, the area becomes a little bit more grey once you actually start to look at the reality of it.
And it was a, it's probably water charges here in Ireland, both in Northern Ireland and in the Republic. It's the hottest of political hot potatoes. And we know what happened in the South in terms of where people complained. And that wasn't, it wasn't introduced there. But I suppose my sense is that what, I think water charges here will be equally as toxic for, mm-hmm. for Northern Ireland politicians. And it would have to be a Secretary of State or something would introduce that. But I think more likely that what we'll see is it's almost a bit like the I can't believe it's not butter. It's I can't believe it's not water charges, where it'll be something called something else, which mm-hmm. will be the de facto water charge. And I would sort of see that the regional rate, whether we see a regional rate escalator going up for the next 5-10 years to try and bring in the revenue that way. Because I think one of the things that I found about public finances in Northern Ireland were whenever the politicians kind of give out the freebies and the kind of devolutionary goodies that they did do, it's almost the default setting is nobody pays anything, as opposed to I think we need to move towards the default setting is everybody pays, and then you look at who doesn't pay and who is opt out, you know, because mm-hmm. otherwise we have Ferrari driving people in Cultraw with their big mansions, you know, are going, Northern Ireland's great. We don't have to pay. Mm-hmm. We get free prescriptions. We get all of that. And that all the people who you would expect anywhere else in the UK would be paying that, mm-hmm. but they're getting away with that here.
I think if you were going to, you know, to close this gap, which, you know, we're saying is opening up in the budget of, I think it's estimated to be about 800 million this year. And in the longer term, you know, I think it's, you know, we shouldn't just focus on this year. The longer term sustainability of public finances should be the aim is, and I would go for it via a regional rate system and increasing regional rates. And as you said, picking a goal over the medium term and escalating your rates over that period. And we had a pretty significant increase in rates this year, and you know, and it happened pretty smoothly.
Yeah,
you know, and as you say, water charges are a politically toxic place for all sorts of notions of, you know, of need, fairness, you know, basic, you know, services of which your society should provide to you. And we've seen this, how this played out in the Republic, you know, people mobilised in their masses. It's a political hot potato that, you know, I don't think, which would be such a distraction to, you know, any discussions about sustainable public finances. And that gets me onto that, you know, the first part of your question about what is sustainable public finances. I think we need to stop talking about sustainable public finances and talk about sustainable economy, because a sustainable economy and a sustainable economy which is growing sustainably over the medium and longer term is one which will provide sustainable public finances. And you have to go back to that conversation. Well, what do you want your society to be? And I think there's multiple parts of this conversation which are kind of happening at the minute but aren't happening, and kind of relates to different parts of the discussion, which we can draw out the different parts. But the DUP calling for a reframing of Barnett or whatever, and kind of this turn towards the needs-based assessment.
And if you maybe just explain to our listeners what sort of the Barnett formula is.
So Northern Ireland gets an allocation of the finances which are distributed through the UK budget, and it's distributed across the different regions of the UK currently based on the Barnett formula. Then changes which happen via the budget each year.
Which is largely population share. So if England gets an increase of £100, we would get roughly like say 2.3% or something like that, whatever the population share is. There's a few other kind of intricacies, adjusting for VAT, the comparability of the spending and stuff, but mm-hmm. that's largely what it is. And one of the interesting things is where Northern Ireland, where the public finances are under particular pressure, is going to be on pay, public sector pay, because what the Secretary of State said, that if there is, as and when we get public sector pay deals happening in England and in GB, that normally you would expect there would be what's called a Barnett consequential, where the population share of whatever that increase would be given to then the executive. They could choose to spend it on something else, but that would be then could be allocated for pay. But what the Secretary of State announced last month is any Barnett consequentials on public sector pay or anything else has to go to pay the 300 million. So that, I suppose, is ratcheting up the pressure for politicians to get back into the executive, because otherwise what's going to happen with public sector pay? Mm-hmm. And we know about the kind of, we're probably heading for a summer of discontent in terms of strikes and things on that front. So, but that's clearly an issue.
Yeah, I'll finish the point on the needs-based assessment where we started there, because this turn and call for to change from the Barnett or the Barnett formula in terms of the distribution of public finances across the UK, and this calls for it to be a needs-based assessment based on the relative need of the Northern Ireland population compared to other regions of our England or the regions of the UK or any notion, I think, that Northern Ireland is going to win that, goal of having a needs-based assessment of public finances for Northern Ireland uniquely is
so we're not as hard done by as we maybe make out.
When we look at the Fiscal Council has just put out a report on this where, they have the need of Northern Ireland in terms of cover of the relative need of Northern Ireland compared to the rest of the UK is about 23%, and we get about the same allocation via our budget. So you can frame it as, and we're not as hard as we're done out, but we also don't get as much as what is often made out. It's often made out that we get much more than what is the case in other places than what is the case of what we need.
That's actually an interesting point, because, well, we've got our kind of devolutionary goodies, which are unique to Northern Ireland in terms of tuition fees, the water charges, free prescriptions, etc. One of the things that you've highlighted a certain conversation with myself is then about, but there's a lot of things which actually people in England get that we don't get. We may get the money for it, but they're not actually delivered. If you'd just like to sort of like unpack that for us.
Yeah, so one of the big areas, and, this has been conceptualized as this concept of sub-parity, where there is certain policy provisions or money allocated via the UK budget to Westminster for particular policies, which then we get the Barnett consequential of. And because it's not necessarily hypothecated, like what you just said in the terms of the public sector pay money coming in, because certain monies aren't hypothecated or ring-fenced in a particular way, they can just be divvied up and shared across all the Northern Ireland departments or whatever. One of the big areas that we've seen in the UK budget this year, and one of the, where they really went for it in terms of, what the budget was about increase in childcare provision. For the first time, the UK government really instilled into its sentiment that childcare is an essential part of economic infrastructure. It's not just something that, should be there, because, some mother wants to work part-time or whatever. It was the first time we've seen this instilled into the UK and UK government as this is an essential part of our economic infrastructure, and we're going to pay and invest in this via childcare provision. Because you could obviously pay it via, but via income, but they, they're looking at the provision of childcare and the funding of childcare. And it was increasing and already made an allocation for 3 and 4 year olds, which has been in England for some years now, of 33 hours of childcare per week. And it was pushing that right back to from 9 months old, a child in England is eligible to get 33 hours of childcare per week. Northern Ireland gets the money for this via our block grant, but we don't get the provision of that because the funding hasn't been hypothecated in the way that it is in England. It comes through via our block grant, but we haven't made the decision ultimately or the choice to spend that on the provision of childcare. And that goes back to our political institutions in many ways, because we haven't had any political institutions in place for long enough to get the childcare strategy off the ground. Yeah. And each time it comes in, we need to redo the childcare strategy. And it's like,
and it's kind of getting worse by the day whenever mortgage interest rates are going up. And I know there's been a group recently have kind of mobilized to bring to attention in terms of the plight of childcare and mm-hmm. the difficulties that it's having for households. And that is going to be a big area which a executive, as and when it's up and running, is going to have to tackle. And the cost of that is quite significant.
The cost of it's quite significant. And even before the cost is the availability and you know, the access to childcare, which Northern Ireland, as a result of not having, as a result of this policy failure, is so far behind in terms of where we're at, where England is at. You currently have 12 and a half hours free childcare for 3 and 4 year olds in Northern Ireland. You know, if you compare that to 33 hours from 9 months to 4 year olds by and around September next year in England, you can see the difficulties which, you know, somebody watching the news or somebody, you know, just going to work or just a normal person in Northern Ireland faces whenever they hear this constant talk about budget deficits and, you know, we can't afford this. This has been cut by that and this has been cut by that. And they're paying their taxes, they're, you know, whenever they go to work, the same way as somebody in England is. And they're looking at it and going, I am spending upwards of a grand more of £1,500 a month, you know, to be able to have my, to pay for childcare. And I'm not seeing it in return.
Yeah, and I think that's one of the things about when you do start paying higher taxes or higher costs, that you then become more demanding of government. And it's, well, we talk about competitiveness. We often think of that's just the private sector, but it's actually the public sector too, is how competitive it can be. And I know I was looking at an article that I'd written about 9 years ago, and it was referring to a book, The Fourth Revolution, The Global Race to Reinvent the State by John Micklethwaite and Adrian Wooldridge. And they were arguing, this was back in kind of 2014 or even earlier, that most states in the West, disillusion with government is widespread. And that certainly has sort of come to pass over the last decade. And they were saying that they argued that having overloaded the state with their demands, voters are now furious that the state actually works so badly, and that systems that serve the Western world for such a long time have become dysfunctional. And while many rule out radical change, what they say is that the status quo is in fact the least likely option. And I suppose that's where, both in terms of the electorate, the politicians, and everybody in concerns of the public finances, if something is unsustainable, at some point it stops. And I think we are going to see tweaks, change, reforms that we've delayed. It's a bit like, I always sort of think with, when it comes to reforms, Northern Ireland's attitude's always been like, the diet starts Monday, where it's like kind of complicated. We'll kick that can down the road. But I think, I said it before 9 years ago, that this time I think there's more pressure than ever before. And what is challenging is any increase in charges, rates, all of those sort of things is coming at a time when taxation is increasing, interest rates are increasing. It's the worst possible time to do it. There were better times years ago that it would have been easier to do sort of like financially, but we're not going to have a choice in maybe selecting the kind of fiscal environment to do this.
2 points I want to make in and around that, that kind of prompted me when you first started talking, was it almost, and it is eeping into the discussion at the minute, it's almost this big society discussion. We've let our public sector get, our public, you know, service expectation get too big. We're expecting too much from our governments. And, you know, it's, you know, this kind of notion that the government can't do everything. And one kind of bit of reality I think we need to, that isn't talked about enough, definitely in the UK sense, is that actually public spending in the UK is below the comparative European average. So we can go a little bit further without becoming in competitive, or, you know, without losing our competitive space, particularly when it comes to, we've done some work on this, particularly when it comes to employer social insurance contributions. The UK and the Republic of Ireland rank far below the European comparator average in terms of the tax take. Granted, the UK government has seen some significant increases in taxation over the most recent budget, and the biggest ones are going to come via the freezing of the income tax thresholds.
Yep.
And as much about where Northern Ireland actually will further the fiscal gap with the rest of the UK, because they're in, you know, we've got so few high income earners at the top end, so that's where much of the gap in terms of income tax take comes from, actually. And it goes back to this kind of DUP point about moving towards a needs-based assessment. I think that we need to be really pushing for a conversation about public finances in the UK as a whole. Some of the things you're talking about, you know, people being dissatisfied, this is right across the UK.
Yeah.
You know, this is not just here. So there, I think we really need to have conversation.
But I think in the likes of health, I think in Northern Ireland, our politicians, normally it's, you know, in the strategy, civil service and in terms of the politicians, is maximise the block grant, as opposed to maximise the outcomes out of your public spending, which they kind of say is a secondary thing. But I sort of think we have had poor outcomes for the level of public spending, say, over the last 10, 15 years.
And that's the second point, that, you know, when we look at Northern Ireland in terms of, you know, the public spending piece and sustainability of the Northern Ireland bit, just not as it relates to the UK. We need to, this really needs to be taken seriously. But you can't take it seriously without investment. You can't think that we're really going to fix our health system without, you know, looking at this in the longer run. This isn't going to come by cutting, you know, departments, budgets, because long-term investment takes an upfront investment in many cases. And you know, to be able to do that, many of the things that were talked about will take an investment into it, and to give that chance for renewal, which puts economic growth at the heart of it.
Yeah, and it's multi-year budgets, and it's also having probably, what are your thoughts on more strings attached, that we actually spend money in a more, a tighter, more defined way, as opposed, you know, whether it's to instill sort of better behaviours in terms of government?
In terms of the no strings attached, definitely, but I think it should be a link to then, okay, what do we want Northern Ireland's economy to become? Northern Ireland's economy has been performing poorly. Let's have an economic strategy and have the strings attached to an economic strategy, which, you know,
10X.
You know, with more detail, you know, which, you know, seeks to do things to grow the economy. Otherwise, you end up back in this conversation, you know, we're saying your finances are unsustainable. If you never address the root of the problem, which is Northern Ireland's poor productivity performance at its root, and, you know, you have this over-reliance continuously, you know, you never give the place a chance. And that's how I really feel about Northern Ireland at the minute. It's in a place of stasis, and no one's given it. You know, there's no chance for the place. And it's, you know, for people to live here at the minute, it's really, it's just negative. You know, everything in terms of the place is just becoming negative in terms of the discussion of public finances, in terms of the cutting of basic things, you know, discretionary supports, you know, for the most vulnerable people, you know, not just small cuts, big, huge chunks of their money, cutting away of community and voluntary sector organisations, which are supporting and, you know, helping people who live here. And without putting the economy first and pushing for sustainable economic growth rather than, you know, which sustainable public finances is part of, rather, you know, one sits in, you know, the economic growth bit sits on top of the sustainable public finances bit. It's the only way forward.
And so just finally, so if it's to, for our fiscal anxiety cure, is it hair of the dog or cold turkey, or is it kind of a bit of both?
I think, you know, we'll have a bit of both. I think, what we can tell from the negotiations, that we're going to have more money coming and a deal that gets the executive back into running. So, you know, that's not cold turkey. That's, you know, that's strings attached, I suppose.
And I suppose the big question will be when the sort of executive comes back up and running. And I know at this time of year, at the end of May, they normally say in the stock market world, sell in May and stay away and don't come back to St. Ledger's Day, which is whenever the horse race in September. And I wonder if that's what the DUP are going to do and come back and sort of St. Ledger's Day and get the executive back up and running. But no, thanks very much. That was Lisa Wilson, senior economist at the Navan Economic Research Institute and Fiscal Commission. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
So what is May's incoming economic data telling us? Well, in terms of the PMI, Northern Ireland's private sector started the second quarter in the same way as it ended the first, with local businesses in expansion mode. Output, orders and employment all increased in April, albeit the pace of growth eased relative to March. Manufacturing was the only sector not to post a decline in output in April, with construction finally recording a rise in activity for the first time in 14 months. Retail also remained very strong, which if any of you were following any of the TikToker who was going around a shopping centre in Lisburn would be surprised at the health of the retail sector here. The trend of easing inflationary pressures continued in April, with input costs rising at the weakest pace in almost 2.5 years. And despite robust rates of wage inflation, all sectors continue to increase their staffing levels in April, with retailers leading the way in the recruitment drive. Construction firms also posted a record rise in staffing levels, which is perhaps a bit surprising, but it would suggest that the softer demand in the sector is enabling long-standing vacancies finally to be filled. Supply chain disruption, which has blighted the economy since the pandemic first hit, but April's PMI survey revealed that firms saw supplier delivery times shorten for the first time since the question was introduced back in March 2021. Overall, the steady improvement in the private sector is in stark contrast with the mounting difficulties within the public sector. Budget cuts and a scaling back of public services will also have implications for parts of the private sector in due course. Turning to the labour market, the local labour market's immunity to negativity could be starting to wane. The number of employees on Northern Ireland's payrolls fell by almost 5,000 in April, which more than offset March's big rise, and April's decline represents the largest monthly fall since the initial reaction to COVID-19 in April 2020. After the first lockdown. Despite this decrease in payrolls, the total number on the payrolls are still over 32,000 above pre-pandemic levels, but with self-employment down by a similar amount, overall employment is just getting back to Q4 2019 levels. It's a similar story with unemployment. The unemployment rate at 2.5% is just a tad above its pre-pandemic rate of 2.4%. Redundancies are few and far between in terms of the statistics, in terms of what has happened to date. But Seagate's recent announcement of over 100 job losses highlights that this could be about to change. It's worth noting that since its arrival in the Northwest in 1993, Seagate has received more cumulative financial assistance than any other firm. And as far as economic development in the Northwest was concerned, it's a disproportionate number of eggs were put into that one basket. Seagate's announcement followed news by BT, which is announcing 55,000 job losses, or 42% of its global workforce, to be cut by the end of the decade. Big losses for Vodafone as well. And also we heard that Norbrook, a pharmaceutical firm, and the likes of First Source, a contact centre that does work for Sky, 200 jobs under threat there. And we've also had our own Ulster Bank, 250 jobs at risk of redundancy. And these jobs have been in the pipeline for a long time, which are linked to the closure of Ulster Bank's operations in the Republic of Ireland, and staff based in Northern Ireland doing work for that entity. Looking at wages, median Northern Ireland earnings for employees rose by 6.6% year on year in April, an impressive rate by historical standards, but still below the corresponding 8.7% increase in CPI. Northern Ireland is also experiencing a significant rise in migration from India. Brexit rule changes have made it harder for workers from the EU to come to work in the UK, but the visa system has been relaxed for high-skilled and medical workers. The net result is an increase in workers from India and Asia. And some interesting analysis by Mark McGill, an economist at Ulster University, who we had on the podcast a few months ago. He was looking at national insurance registrations data. And for the financial year that's just ended, 2022-23, India accounted for the largest migrant share of registrations. In 2015-16, India accounted for only 225 registrations, but that is just 6% of the latest annual total of over 3,700. After India, the Republic of Ireland and then Ukraine are the two largest sources of registrations on the national insurance figures. Just looking at the national insurance figures for before Brexit, 2015-2016, people coming from the EU to work in Northern Ireland, but excluding Ireland, was 77%, whereas now it is just 8%. Conversely, rest of the world has increased from 12% to 78% over the same time period. Looking at inflation, UK CPI finally fell into single-digit territory for the first time in 8 months. Although April's 8.7% print was much stronger than expected. Energy and food price rises have dominated the inflation headlines over the last year, but it's what lies beneath these headlines that is concerning. The latest inflation figures could be summed up by the phrase core blimey, with core CPE, which excludes food, energy, alcohol and tobacco, jumped from 6.2% to 6.8% year on year. That's a 31-year high. Mobile phone charges more than doubled to 7.9%, and increased costs of second-hand cars were also part of a broad-based picture of price rises. Services inflation also hit a 31-year high of 6.9%. Having the headline CPI rate this year, which is what Jeremy Hunt has set that objective, it is still achievable if we hit 4.7% by year end, but having the core CPI rate is not, and the risk of a more persistent inflation is clearly crystallizing. And persistence is a word we are likely to hear more about in the months ahead. And the sobering implication of the latest shock inflation figures is that the Bank of England will probably need to engineer a recession in order to get inflation under control. That means higher interest rates and bank rate of at least 5% and potentially beyond that. Financial markets are currently pricing in a peak of 5.5% before the end of the year. UK food prices rose by 19.3% in April, but the trend in global world food commodity prices has been down. The global food price index hit a 23-month low in March and is down 22% from March 22's peak, although April saw the first monthly rise in the UN food commodity price index in 13 months. Even with these falls in global food prices, we still expect food and drink inflation in the UK to be running at between 6 and 7% by the end of next year. That will still be painful for consumers. And given the food price outlook, we are likely to see even more shrinkflation. That is where the size of the product shrinks to soften price rises. Hellmann's mayonnaise is the latest product to succumb to shrinkflation, with the 800-gram jars being shrunk by 25% to 600-gram jars. They've also thrown in a 4% increase, or 15 pence. But looking at these changes in their totality, shrinkflation is actually concealing a price hike of 39% when you look at the price per gram of mayonnaise. In the housing market, Northern Ireland's residential property price index posted its second successive quarterly decline in the first quarter of 2023. The 1.8% drop was the largest in a decade and follows the marginal 0.4% quarterly decline in the previous quarter. The latest declines have halved the annual rate of house price growth in Northern Ireland to 5%, with the standardised house price now at £172,000. All property types, semis, detached, apartments, terrace, etc., saw price falls, but one segment of the housing market continues to see prices rising, and that is the new build sector. New dwellings prices are less than 12% of their freak peak back in the third quarter of 2007, but they have risen by 13% over the last year. Conversely, second-hand houses have recorded two successive quarters of price falls, and their annual rate of price growth has slowed to just over 3% per year. Second-hand houses are still a hefty 26% below their freak peak in Q3 2007. Given the surge in energy costs and mortgage rates, fixer-uppers and energy inefficient houses have fallen out of favour with first-time buyers, in contrast to new builds. The problem for house hunters is that the stock of new builds coming onto the market is slowing. New housing starts in the first quarter of this year were down 29% year on year, and it was the worst Q1 for starts since 2014. Fewer starts mean fewer completions in roughly 9 months' time, and over the last 3 years, there were approximately 1,700 fewer houses started than would have occurred if 2019's pre-pandemic rate of building had continued. Looking at completed units in the first quarter of 2023, they fell by a quarter year on year and are one third below the corresponding quarter in 2019. Indeed, the first quarter of this year was the worst Q1 for housing completions in 8 years. The rental sector is also experiencing a glowing lack of supply, and according to Ulster University estimates, this stock of private rental properties has halved since 2015. More people chasing fewer properties is fueling 10% year-on-year rent increases, which is double the national rate of increase. Car dealers saw a 6.8% year-on-year increase in new car sales in April, and that was the best April in 4 years. But outside of the pandemic, April 2023 was still the worst April since 2012. Looking at the year-to-date, sales of new cars for the first 4 months of the year are up 17% year-on-year, but are still down almost a fifth of the corresponding four-month period back in 2019. While global supply chain volatility has returned to pre-pandemic levels, there are still shortages with semiconductors, which is adversely affecting car production and impacting on new car sales as a result. So what about the month ahead? The Bank of England's MPC has raised interest rates at each of its last 12 meetings. And following the core blimey inflation surprise last week, a 25 basis points hike on the 22nd of June to 4.75% looks like a slam dunk. We expect another rise to 5% in August, and they could go beyond that before the end of the year. As I highlighted earlier, financial markets are currently pricing in a peak of 5.5% by November. And just remember, back in November 2021, rates were 0.1%. May's CPI inflation is also expected to ease marginally from 8.7% to around about 8.5%. But the focus going forward for the rest of the year is going to be on the core CPI, or underlying inflation. And this is expected to nudge up from April's 31-year high towards 7%. On the local economic release front, we have the PMI data for May, with the run of three successive months of growth expected to continue for a fourth month. Of more interest will be the HMRC payrolls figure. Following the sizable fall in April, we'll be watching to see if this is the start of a downward trend. Industrial action and an absence of acceptable public sector pay deals are likely to lead into a summer of discontent. And finally, there's been a distinct shift in my personal spending habits in recent weeks. As I am due to become a granddad, I'm now finding myself shopping for baby accessories. And rather than looking for new electric cars, I'm now looking at car seats to fit in the recently purchased electric car. Until next time, I am Richard Ramsay, and this was episode 28 of the Ulster Economics Podcast, Fiscal Anxiety Cure Required, Hair of the Dog or Cold Turkey, with Lisa Wilson of the Nevin Economic Research Institute. You can stay up to date by following us on social media and the ulstereconomics.com blog.